Good morning. The court calls United States v. Halpin. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Justice Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. To explain why an appellant took his wife home rather than to a hospital after attempted bill divorce, the trial counsel argued to his family members that, quote, only Aaron Halpin himself knows why he acted in such a callous and wanton manner that night. And only he knows whether or not he was actually hoping or wanting his wife to die. But one could certainly argue that it would have worked out pretty well for him had she passed away. The arguments would stop. The impending divorce, expense, and effort of it would be saved. Potentially, he could collect on her SGLI payout. End quote. The members of the court, there was no evidence on the record that the appellant was the
counsel. Before you get into whether or not this is improper argument, why isn't this waived? Doesn't 1001G say that if you don't object to improper argument before the judge starts to instruct, it's waived?
It does say that, Your Honor, absolutely.
So why isn't it waived?
Because this court, in a series of cases, in Marsh, for instance, in Knickerbocker going older to the CMA, have always looked to plain error in this case rather than finding waiver.
Well, you also have an ineffective assistance claim, don't you?
Yes, Judge Baker, and we have an IAC claim which would kind of negate the idea that it should be waived.
Do the parties agree on the, as you see it, having read the briefs, do the parties agree on the standard of law that would apply to improper argument?
It seems so, yes, Your Honor.
And what is that standard?
In a case like this, in a context like this, without the objection being made, it would be a plain error standard.
I'm sorry, but what would be the standard for determining whether there was error? What is it? What is a prosecutor allowed to do or a counsel allowed to do?
The prosecutor has to stay within the bounds that have been set by case law, by the rules, by the norms.
Right. What I'm trying to ask is whether the parties agree on what those bounds are without doing the leading question. One is allowed to comment on the evidence and fair inferences from the evidence. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think the parties agree on that? I'm trying to figure out if there's a difference of view on the law or whether there's a difference of view on how it applies in
understood.
This context.
Yes, yeah. Your Honor. Understood. No, I believe the parties certainly do not agree with that. The government's case seems to be mostly these were either facts in evidence or there were fair inferences from the evidence.
And you don't disagree with the statement, though, facts or fair inference, right?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So you're here to argue that it's law applied to fact, not law, that's the issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And can you come up with a better plain English definition of fair inference than something that is fairly inferred? Can you spare us the misery we've been suffering?
I believe
chambers?
So.
Okay, go ahead.
In the Supreme Court case of Barnes versus United States, they said that an inference is irrational or arbitrary and hence unconstitutional, though that doesn't apply in this case, unless it can be at least said with a substantial assurance that the assumed or presumed fact is more likely than not to flow from the proved fact on which it is made to depend. So with substantial assurance, more likely than not. And that, if that's met, it's a reasonable inference. If it's not met, it's an unreasonable inference. And then going back, certainly an SGLI payout, in this case, is an unreasonable inference. There's no evidence that he would have been the beneficiary of any life insurance policy. Nor is there any evidence on the record.
But didn't he qualify that with potentially?
He did say potentially, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it potentially possible? Isn't it potentially a fact that she's a spouse of a military member, that she had SGLI, and that he potentially would be the beneficiary of it?
It is potentially the fact in the same nature that almost anything is a potentiality.
I think that military members, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but military members do get SGLI, correct?
The military member certainly gets an SGLI, and that would be a reasonable.
What about their spouses?
There's no evidence on the record whether or not a spouse is entitled
to SGLI.
I'm
not asking you about evidence on the record. I'm asking you about, like, common knowledge within the military. Don't most military spouses also get SGLI?
I would say that that's not common knowledge, Your Honor. I do not know whether or not the SLI plan for a spouse is an opt-in plan or if it's an opt-out plan. Is it automatic and then you have to say, I don't want it? Or is it something that's there but you have to ask, for it? And I would say that most members probably don't know that either.
Well, all I'm suggesting is that by using the word potentially, I think that that makes your argument lose some of its force because of the way that the words were phrased.
Well, potentially in this case, Your Honor, and I understand the question. Potentially, if they had something else on the record, then he could say potentially. But here we have, and there's actually two problems with this. Again, there's no evidence whether or not she would have actually been covered by the NSGLI plan. And there's no evidence, again, whether or not he would have even been a beneficiary of said plan if there was any evidence that plan existed in the first place. But that also leads into a second problem with the trial counsel's argument. The SGLI plan, the whole idea of gaining from an SGLI plan or a life insurance policy, doesn't matter unless death was a likely occurrence from this. Now, this, like I said, leads into a second problem, which is the trial counsel's focus during the sentencing argument upon the likelihood of death in this case. And this takes a little bit of setup. Reckless endangerment obviously requires an act that is either likely to result in death or likely to result in grievous bodily injury. Now, in this case, the appellant, in speaking to the judge during the care inquiry, made it very, very, very apparent that what we're talking about here was the theory of grievous bodily injury, and that grievous bodily injury, I'm taking that to the next step, was the potential for liver damage in his wife on down the road. Liver damage, not death. The judge didn't focus on death in the care inquiry. Indeed, the stipulation of facts specifically said, and I quote, that any death from Mrs. Halpin's overdose would have been, quote, extremely rare, even in the most extreme doses. And that's from the stipulation of fact.
Well, counsel, is your argument that the facts that he argued couldn't reasonably be inferred from the facts that were in evidence? Or is your argument that the facts that he argued constitute an offense with which he wasn't charged and that the government didn't pursue? Do you see the difference?
I do see the difference, Your Honor. No, the argument is the former. Based on the facts on this record, he could not make the inferences that he was making, that he was
arguing. So you don't think that the facts in this record, if the government had elected to charge him with attempted manslaughter or attempted murder or some greater offense, you don't think that the facts in this record that they could have, I'm not saying that they would have, but that they could have supported that offense?
If the facts came out in that hypothetical case as they came out in this case, no, that would not support the offense. Because the only thing we're talking about is potential liver damage. We're not talking about potential death. There's no.
Well, that's what he stipulated to. I mean, that's what he stipulated to.
It was a stipulation of fact, Your Honor. Yes, in the stipulation of fact, it was a death would have been extremely rare, even in the most extreme doses. Yes, Your Honor. So, again, going into that second line, even though the stipulation of fact says extremely rare and most extreme doses, even though the judge during the care inquiry.
What about his statement, I don't want her to die in my apartment? You seem to be focusing on the most favorable aspect of the stipulation of fact. But what about the least favorable aspects? Are they not in play as well?
No, they certainly are in play, Ron. They certainly are. And just to clarify, when she testified in a certain way. But the stipulation of fact actually has the order slightly backwards, and she adds one bit to that that is not in her in the stipulation of fact. So, according to the stipulation of fact, she took the pills, and then he says, "You're not going to die in this apartment," and she says, "You're going to watch me die." And then, according to her testimony, there's a gap. She doesn't know if it's 5 minutes or an hour because her memory is fading. But there's a gap, and then he says calmly, "I'm going to take it home." And that's it. So, I mean, based on that, I don't think that gets the trial counsel to the idea that he hoped and wanted her to die, and or that there was a likelihood of death in this case in the first place. Again, the trial judge focuses on the liver damage aspect of it. The stipulation of fact says it would have been extremely rare. Even in her own testimony, in Mrs. Halpin's own testimony, she says, I went to the hospital the next day. They took blood, they took urine, they found no toxicity in my system. But then based on that, the trial counsel comes into the sentencing argument that the appellant was endangering her life. Specifically, he says at JA 150, speaking of the next day when the appellant was informed that she was in the hospital, he says, quote, he was informed that she had survived by the grace of God, or luck, or whatever you want to call it. Well, the stipulation and all the facts do say that he was informed that she was going to the hospital. But the survived by the grace of God, or luck, or whatever you want to call it, is the trial counsel's editorializing or arguing on this. And certainly the clear implication of that argument is, members, it's only by the grace of God that she survived. But the facts only are talking about liver damage.
Well, counsel, that's what he stipulated to, all right? But there's no evidence in the record that she couldn't have died. There's words in the stipulation of fact that suggested that at one point he said that she was not going to die in his apartment, even if she testified differently. It's his stipulation of fact.
That's right.
Okay? So I don't think that you can make the argument that it wasn't possible.
And I'm certainly not saying that it's not possible, except we have a stipulation of fact that all parties agreed to was a fact. I mean, even the trial counsel agreed that this is a fact, that a death from this would have been extremely rare, even in the most extreme doses. So, I mean, it's a fact, and it's not like it's his stipulation of expected testimony. It's a stipulation of fact.
Right, but rare doesn't mean it couldn't happen.
No, absolutely.
I mean, I think the argument that you should be making, to the extent you should be making this argument at all, is that the problem with all of this is that what he was arguing was an offense that was different than the one that he pleaded to. My question is, you know, are you permitted to do that?
This court, from what the appellant could find, has not ruled on such a scenario. The Air Force Court has, in an older case of Martinez in 1990, and in that case, it was the accused in that case was being tried on an aiding and abetting theory of murder. He pled guilty under an aiding and abetting theory of murder. He went through a care inquiry under that theory. The judge found him guilty of that theory. And then the trial counsel turned around and argued in sentencing that he was the principal in that case. And the Air Force Court said, you can't do that. Once the judge has found you guilty of a certain theory, that forecloses the possibility of going to other theories. So that's another aspect, Your Honor. But it's certainly not the only aspect of this.
Well, even assuming that it's error, since even assuming that there was error, how is it plain and obvious, and how is your client prejudiced? I mean, he received a 10-month sentence.
Certainly, Your Honor.
When he agreed to a pretrial agreement capping his confinement at 7.5 years,
certainly.
Right?
But going back to the plain and obvious aspect of it, it should be obvious to any trial counsel that arguing a factually baseless motive that is so egregious as he wanted her to die in order to get an extra life out, to get a monetary payout, is obvious. But it's also against the clear weight of the case law. The CMA addressed a similar situation in the United States v. Clifton. That was a findings case, but in Clifton, the trial counsel was discoursing upon the motives of a rapist without any facts to support such motives. And the CMA said you can't do that. That's clear. It's obvious that you can't do that. Same with the likelihood of death. There are no facts to say that it was likely that she was going to die. So to sit there and argue that she's likely going to die, which is certainly more egregious and more inflammatory than liver damage. So he's taking it from liver damage up to death. That should be plain and obvious to anyone. And then turning to
But I mean, counsel, we're talking about what was his motive at the time that he did what he did. I mean, she ended up with liver damage, right? But I mean, did he know that at the time that he moved, left her alone in her apartment after moving him from his apartment?
There's no evidence that she even ended up with liver damage. But to back
what
up,
I'm saying is, you know, he's talking about why did he do what he did, right? That's what he's arguing about. Why did he do what he did? And at the time he did what he did, who knows what he did? I mean, in stipulation of fact, he said, you know, you're not dying in my apartment, words to that effect, and then he removed her and left her alone in her apartment.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's a huge jump to go from you're not going to die in this apartment to he must have wanted her to die and wanted an extra life benefit.
Well, counsel, we have more here, I think, than a lack of gallantry. This may not have been a relationship made in heaven, but come on, you know, you're not going to die in this apartment. I'm going to take you home. He takes her home. He dumps her. He does put his coat on her. And then he walks out the door. after she said, you know, and of course, when she took the pill, she said, I am too going to die in this apartment. So I think we've got a little more than a lack of gallantry here.
No,
but what I want to get to is prejudice. You had a very favorable PTA, and you got what was basically a pretty generous sentence. So where's prejudice? Even assuming that this argument was improper, that it was plain error, and you're saying plain error applies, where's the prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. First, the importance to keep in mind that this is not a sentence severity argument. The question in this is whether or not this court can be confident that the appellant was sentenced based on the evidence alone. So that's the focus that we're going after. It's not necessarily the raw numbers of what he ended up getting at the end of the day, but whether or not we can be confident that he was sentenced upon the evidence alone. And certainly, in this case, we cannot be. I mean, confidence is based on the severity of the misconduct, the measures that the military judge adopted to cure the misconduct, and the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence from Erickson. Certainly, turning to the second factor first, the measures adopted to cure the misconduct, there were no measures adopted to cure the misconduct, no specific measures to adopt to cure the misconduct. There were the general standards, but with no curative instructions. The severity of the sentence, or the severity of the improper argument, though, in this case, arguing without the basis in fact.
Were the members instructed that argument wasn't evidence?
They were not, Your Honor.
They were
instructed that if you hear a sentence, that is just the personal opinion of counsel, but they were not instructed that argument is not a sentence, or that argument.
Well, isn't the personal opinion of the counsel normally not evidence? I mean, isn't that saying the same thing in a different way?
Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, it's the difference between saying when he says he wants 10 months, that's just his personal opinion, versus when he says that he wanted her to die in order to get an extra life benefit, that's just his personal opinion. I mean, those are two very different things. And the judge specifically said, we're just...
You're losing me here.
Well, the judge didn't say anything about... Nothing the judge said could have put it in the members' minds, hey, when he said SGLI benefit, that was just his personal opinion. There was nothing in the instructions that would have given a reasonable person that type of idea. But going back to the prejudice analysis...
Your time is up. Are you answering a question, or are you proceeding to a new argument?
I believe I'm answering a question. With your permission, Your Honor, may I finish that?
Please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Certainly we have this... From a liver damage up to a likelihood of death, and we have a motivation that's not based on the facts for an SGLI payout. And you base that up against, and you bump that up against the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence in this case, and certainly the prejudice factor is certainly favorable for the opponent in this case.
May I ask one question on ineffective assistance?
Sure.
Affidavit from the defense counsel talks about strategic decisions. The government's brief simply notes the strategic decision but doesn't explain it. In your view, just talking about prong one of ineffective assistance, are you doubting the credibility of the defense counsel's reason here, or are you taking the position that it could not be a strategic decision, and if so, why?
Your Honor, I would say that I'm taking a third option. It's not that it could not be. I'm certainly not doubting the credibility of the defense counsel in this case. And I'm not saying that it could not have been a strategic decision. But what I'm saying is the defense counsel's affidavit does not present any idea that he understood that there was something going on and that he made a decision. He just says it was strategically more effective at the end of the day. But he doesn't say, I made the decision to make it strategically more effective. So in order to have some strategic decision, there needs to be a decision made in the first place.
Thank you.
With that, Your
Thank
Honor,
you.
I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, Captain Brian Mason, along with Mr. Joe Bruce, represent the United States in this matter.
Now, appellant's petition, which petition brief, which slices out portions, small portions of the trial counsel's 16-page argument, and then uses those slices to paint a picture, a certain picture, is simply not reflective of the overall trial counsel's argument, which looked at in the concept of in the whole and in the context of what he was speaking about, was completely proper. Trial counsel here argued facts that were in evidence and fair and reasonable inferences drawn therefrom. Appellant may not have liked the or even agreed with the inferences that the trial counsel...
It was a fair inference that he wanted her to die to get the SGLI benefits?
Well, Your Honor, I think the way that it's argued, the context that he laid out is, we don't know what was going on in the appellant's mind. Potentially it was this, potentially it was that, and just sort of threw these things out. And then,
so if you don't know, it's a fair inference to draw that conclusion?
But Your Honor, we never really know what's going on in an appellant's brain, so we have to look at the circumstantial evidence. And the evidence that was there in the record was...
Was there any circumstantial evidence that there was an SGLI on the spouse?
Other than the common knowledge of the routine personnel action that service members get life insurance, no, Your Honor, there wasn't any other evidence in the record.
Did the person, did the counsel say that but again, there's no evidence to show he did that?
That's right, Your Honor.
So what the rest of the sentence was, there's no evidence to show that he did that, but of course it's a fair inference to otherwise conclude such. I mean, it's not particularly helpful to say this is a fair argument if the person making the argument himself says there's no evidence to base it on.
Well, I would agree to a certain extent, Your Honor, from the standpoint of this was not really the focus of his argument. It was six words within a 16-page argument.
That's a different argument than saying everything's proper. Don't worry about it.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. You're exactly right. And our position first is that it was proper. It was, a possible potential motivation for it, but the focus of the trial counsel argument, looking at it in the whole, was from the standpoint of, and looking at the whole thing that he presented, was this: this is somebody that doesn't care. This is somebody that doesn't is not concerned about the work of their brothers.
Well, counsel, do you agree that his argument could be read to suggest that he wanted or hoped that she would die, and that that's a different offense than reckless endangerment? I mean, wanting someone to die, isn't that different? Intent, isn't that closer to intending that they die?
It's certainly closer, Your Honor. I don't know that it raises to a different offense. I think looking at the argument that he made, he's arguing the facts. These are aggravating facts in terms of the pill bottles and the jacket.
But the question, at least in my mind, is he arguing fear? Leaving aside the question whether they're fair inferences from the facts, my question to you is the same as it is was to appellant's counsel, which is, you know, is he arguing facts that could be read to create a greater offense? And if so, is that permissible? I mean, the appellant's counsel cited an Air Force case. I'm not aware of any case law from this court on it. Are you?
I'm not, Your Honor. And I'd like to emphasize the Martinez case that the defense counsel did ask. I'll talk about that in a second. To answer your question directly, Your Honor, arguing a higher offense, can they do it? Certainly the Air Force Court held in Martinez that they couldn't. This court hasn't specifically stated. I'm not aware of any cases. But the Martinez case is very different from this case. In the Martinez case, there was actually an agreement to not go forward on the higher charge. They changed the specification. In order to go with the aider and abettor theory versus the principal or the premeditated actor theory. And then the trial counsel still argued on that. The military judge did not make those findings, and that's a problem in that Martinez case.
Counsel, do you agree with appellant's citing the Supreme Court decision in Barnes as to the definition of fair inference?
I don't, Your Honor.
And why wouldn't we apply that?
I think holding a fair inference to a preponderance standard is too high.
More likely than not?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Well, you can argue that it's too high, but why wouldn't we apply it? I mean, if that's what the Supreme Court says is a fair definition of it.
Well, I don't read Barnes to say that arguments by counsel, that's the inference they're talking about. The way I read Barnes is more that's a permissive inference regarding evidence rather than argument itself. Then it wasn't dealing with a sentencing argument situation at all. So to limit counsel on either side to say you can't argue a fair inference unless there's a more likely than not determination.
So what's your definition of fair inference? What's your definition,
Your Honor? I'd agree with Judge Baker. It is a difficult one to sort of put a handle on, but I would say that an inference at some point becomes so untenable that it's unreasonable. Where that line is, Your Honor, I don't know. But it certainly shouldn't be as high as the preponderance of the evidence standard. Was it reasonable belief? Is it probable cause? We put a label on that. I'll leave that to the wise discretion of the court. But
so if you had to give us your standard in one sentence, what would it be?
An inference fails to become fair if it reaches a point that is so untenable it becomes unreasonable.
Pretty high. I want to talk a minute about the possibility of a greater offense. When he said that no one knows whether he actually was hoping or wanted his wife to die, that to me appears to plant the seeds that he wanted her to die. I mean, he certainly couched it in kind of a subtle manner, but it planted the seeds. And that goes to, as Judge Ryan noted, that may go to an element of intent. And then he bolsters that by saying he can get her insurance and he won't have to mess around with the trouble of the divorce and they'll stop fighting. Those all go to motive. And so it appears to me what we're looking at is a voluntary manslaughter charge where the sentence, the maximum sentence, is 12 years, attempted voluntary manslaughter. And I'm just concerned, particularly when the Air Force Court has already spoken on this, that he is arguing elements of a greater offense when the appellant has pled guilty to a lesser culpable offense. And why wouldn't that have an effect and inflame the jury?
Well, Your Honor, for a few reasons. I think one of the main issues in Martinez and the reason why the trial counsel's argument was problematic is because Martinez in that case was already charged with a higher offense. And then when it came down to trial, the specification was changed in accordance with an agreement. So everybody was in agreement, we're not going forward on this higher offense, and we're going forward on this lower offense. So it's problematic for trial counsel to say, okay, these are aggravated.
So if there isn't an agreement, in your view, it's legitimate to argue a higher offense?
I think it's legitimate, Your Honor, to argue the facts. If the facts are, and reasonable inferences, as I would contend that the trial counsel did here, if the facts show and could show the motive, certainly the reason why a person commits a criminal offense is going to be important for the sentencing authority to think.
But in reckless endangerment, there's no intent and there's no motive involved.
Well, Your Honor, this was charged a willful and wanton endangerment. He pled to that. So what's going on in his mind is important for the sentencing authority to know.
So, counsel, if we have an assault offense, let's say a plain assault offense that and there's no bargaining down, et cetera. That's what's charged. And the evidence in the case shows that a knife was waived. Can the trial counsel argue in that case the defendant, the accused in this case, waived a knife? And while there's no evidence of what was in his mind, you can reasonably infer based upon the no unreasonable alternative language that you suggested that he intended to cause death or grievous bodily harm. Now, that might be a reasonable inference under a very low standard. So can you argue in an assault case that the person has committed the higher offense because there's no evidence as to what was in his mind, and therefore we can speculate based on the waving of the knife?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a couple issues with your scenario that I would have a problem with. First is arguing the higher offense. If we look at the trial counsel's argument here, he didn't argue the higher offense. He argued facts that a lawyer or other individual may be aware of meets the elements of a higher offense. But he's not arguing this was really a premeditated murder. So I think that was something that I think in your scenario would be a problem. The second, Your Honor, is...
Well, what's your answer to my question, and then you can answer your question, okay? As my question, is that permissible in the assault case?
I think the way that you've described it, Your Honor, no, that would not be permissible from the standpoint.
Okay, and that explain now. Yeah, I'll go ahead and explain why it's different here.
It's different here, Your Honor, because trial counsel did not make the argument of the higher offense. And also it's different because we have these common knowledge that all military members get SGLI. In fact, you have to opt out. Everyone in the military knows that. So you know, we have one dependent at the time, his 20-year-old wife, that she would be the beneficiary, or that he would be the beneficiary for his SGLI is not an unreasonable inference. So, and then as Judge Ryan noted earlier.
You're giving an unreasonable inference about a legislative fact or a non-legislative fact. I mean, it may be that the knowledge of SGLI is so common that one could argue in a case involving SGLI alone that virtually everybody has it. What is the basis for arguing that every spouse is the beneficiary of SGLI? That is, where would we look in terms of either legislative or adjudicated facts, however you want to call it, what's the basis in law for this court taking that into account?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the basis is looking at those six words that the trial counsel uttered, and the first one that he did, which was potential. We know from the personal data sheet that's there in the joint appendix that there are no other dependents. So at the time, they're married, she is presumably the only dependent. So potentially, as the trial counsel said, he could have received her SGLI. That's all we're talking about is potentially. I was just throwing things out there. And again, and I know I'm kind of shifting.
So you could say potentially he can carry on his five affairs with people in Alaska. He potentially could do a lot of things. He could potentially buy the new Cadillac he'd been looking at. It potentially covers anything in the world.
It does, Your Honor, but we have other facts in here. If he had said potentially he wanted to continue a relationship with the airman that he had adultery with, I think that would have been fair.
Or if this was a sister or a parent that was involved, he could say, well, potentially the SGLI would have gone to the sister or parent because he joined the military and could have designated them as beneficiaries as well.
Certainly there are an infinite number of scenarios, yes, Your Honor.
And is that so rare for a person to designate someone other than a spouse that you couldn't potentially argue it? Do we have any basis for knowing here at the appellate level?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Is there a public policy reason why the government would want argument like this to be admitted?
Which point, the overall context of the argument, Your Honor, or any particular
this
cases?
Particular stuff about the SGLI and motive? I mean, are you here arguing this because that's what you do when you're in an adjudicative process or adversarial process? Or is there some principle that would say we really need to preserve trial counsel's argument to come in and argue motive on reckless endangerment cases?
I think it's not necessarily in reckless endangerment cases, yes, Your Honor, but I think it's an important consideration by the sentencing authority if there is some evidentiary basis or reasonable inferences that can be presented to them about why a person commits a crime, that goes to the rehabilitative potential. And I think that's the way it was presented in the context of this whole argument. That's really what trial counsel was doing here. He's focusing on an individual who, through the evidence, showed that he did not care about anything other than what he wanted. That was the theme of the argument, the 16-page argument. It wasn't just the way that the statements came out in these two pages that appellant really spends most of his time on his brief.
Well, counsel, let's, just for purposes of our discussion today, let's assume that it was error. Could you address whether it was plain or obvious?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, I think the most compelling piece of this, Your Honor, is as you look at this entire argument, you can see that these portions, and I know I just mentioned it, is a small portion within a very large argument. In a sentencing, guilty plea, sentencing only case, 16 pages on the main argument, 2 pages in rebuttal, this is a very small piece. And if we're focused specifically on the...
Doesn't that go to prejudice?
Sir?
Doesn't that go to prejudice more than whether it's plain or obvious?
Yes, Your Honor, I guess I misunderstood your question. I was talking about prejudice.
I mean, the test is whether or not it's error, and then whether it's plain or obvious error, and then if it is, whether there was prejudice. So let's get back to whether or not it, why this wasn't plain or obvious, which
yes, Your Honor.
I assume is your argument.
I think the most compelling argument that it's not plain error is the standpoint that it was six words, and I know I keep coming back to that. He didn't hit on the argument. He said potentially in front of it, and there was a reasonable basis to conclude, given the fact that this is it's a common military action, that people have SGLI. It's not plain or obvious. The judge didn't have a duty to step in or issue any kind of curative instruction on this. And frankly, the trial counsel didn't spend very much time developing and expanding on that argument. He made it that his next comment was regardless, and then he focused more on the conduct. So there isn't a plain or obvious area here because we're really not talking about that much, which really sort of leads to the prejudice piece as well.
Is that the standard for plain or obvious? It sounds to me like you're still talking about prejudice, and that is there's this, you know, this much of an argument and only this much deals with the small point. But the small point, the question is only on that point, whether that's plain or obvious at that point. So could you address that? Why would it not be plain or obvious in the case? I understand you're not conceding, not asking you to concede that it's even error. But assuming it's error, let's take our SGLI example. Why would that not be plain or obvious that arguing to a higher offense based on the SGLI would be inappropriate?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think looking at the words, he didn't talk about the higher offense or how it motive meant. So to get to that plain or obvious for a judge listening to this argument, and this is 5 pages into his sentencing argument already, and he goes for several pages afterwards.
Yes, so you're going back to the prejudice argument. Please insert the following. What if you said, well, it's only six words, so we'll say he is worse than Charles Manson. Would you agree that's improper argument in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You would not be here then saying it's only six words. You'd say, why is that or is not plain in that context to say that? And you say, well, clearly plain error because it's intended to incite the passions of the members and it has no relationship to this. So now just take these statements and pretend that we're asking you, why are these statements, as in the Charles Manson scenario, plain or obvious error or not?
I guess my difficulty in being able to answer your question, Your Honor, is I'm having a hard time getting past the point of error. So to say that it's plain or obvious, when we haven't, I'm having a hard time getting past that hurdle. So to sort of assume that, I mean, certainly six words, as Chief Judge Baker just mentioned, certainly six words could...
Well, it's not exactly six words. It depends who's counting, right?
I'm counting from potentially.
Okay. But let's rephrase it. If we characterize it as a statement that he wanted her dead to collect the SGLI payment, this was an effort to kill her to get the SGLI payment. Why would that be plain or obvious error or not?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that's closer to an actual assertion of fact. That the trial counsel is saying this is the way it is, which I don't think we have in this case. We have a situation where he's sort of throwing things out. So I think that makes it more plain or obvious. If there's no other evidence there, now the trial counsel is sort of injecting evidence.
Well, you said that there's no evidence of this, you know, and then he went on to give these examples.
Those were his words, Your Honor, absolutely.
Yeah.
But again, at the same time, we all know in the military.
Should it not be obvious to pay attention when someone says, again, there is no evidence to show that he did that? Is that a clue that there might be some plain something coming up?
It could be, Your Honor. It could be, or it could just be a junior trial counsel that doesn't fully understand the concept.
Counsel, is your argument this, that in the government's view, it's so plain that there's no error here that you're either going to win on no error or on no prejudice, and you've got no argument one way or another on plain and obvious. Is that where you are?
Well, essentially where I am, Your Honor, is pretty close, Your Honor. I don't even think this court needs to get to issue two or three. Issue one really is the dispositive issue, and our position is there isn't an error here. And certainly with the prejudice aspect. So, yes, Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head.
Quickly on ineffective assistance. prong one, assuming there's error, and I think it's easier to assume for purposes of IAC, assuming there's error, what was the strategic decision that the council was making that brings this within, not within Strickland prong one? What strategic decision? It's not apparent from your brief. It's not particularly apparent from the affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor. And Chief Judge, if I may, I'd like to answer the question.
Of course.
The strategic decision, Your Honor, and in looking at trial defense counsel's argument on sentence, was to portray his client in a manner that was this troubled man and laying out the suicide attempts that he had had and the issues that he had had. And really, you can see it from the way he presented his evidence all through, which is this is somebody who took full responsibility for what happened, and trial counsel is going to portray this in a really bad way, but the way I'm going to portray it contrasts with that. So if we notice, we go through the sentencing argument, trial defense counsel didn't object to the sentencing argument, and as you look at it from his affidavit, and giving the proper deference presumptions to his competence, there's no reason to. He's got his plan. He's executing his plan. And frankly, he won this trial before he walked in the door with the favorable PTA. So to even with all of his plan that he executed to get it less in terms of the overall cap, trial defense counsel was very effective.
Well, 10 months confinement is 10 months more than no confinement or 1 month or two.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. But he had also committed.
And if he's already won the case, is that the standard that we use for this is a special court martial, right?
Yes, sir.
Special court martial's got 12 months confinement max. Is trial defense counsel then relieved of the responsibility on sentencing because, hey, the worst thing that can happen to my client is 12 months, so I'm not going to worry about it?
Certainly not, Your Honor. Certainly, he's obligated to provide effective assistance throughout. One of the considerations, though, Your Honor, is how has this representation been from A to Z?
Right. And what strategic value was served in this case by not asking for a curative instruction after the argument? How would the counsel's argument at all been undermined by such an instruction?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, he may not have even viewed it as error, talked about, but he had a plan, and maybe he believed it was in his best interest to have the trial counsel way out over in left field and then to portray it in a more reasonable fashion, which is essentially looking at his argument and his affidavit. That seems to be his plan.
But he didn't say that precisely in his affidavit, did he? Did he say that it was to my advantage for him to be way out there and look foolish?
Well, he didn't say it like that, Your Honor. He said it in contrast with the extreme portrayal of trial counsel's facts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there a rebuttal?
Counsel, you've raised three different claims before us, all dealing with the same central issue. Given the different standards that we would apply to each of those three, which of the three is your best argument?
I believe the trial counsel misconduct or the plain error and the improper argument would be the best.
The IAC.
No, the trial counsel.
The trial
counsel misconduct.
Is all improper argument misconduct? Are they synonymous?
I don't know. I can't. It's hard to hypothesize where you have a potential improper argument that does not also. What makes it by virtue of. Let me back up here. It is going against some norm that makes the argument improper in the first place. Therefore, if there is an improper argument, then you do have the violation of a norm, and therefore, yes, it would be.
Does all improper argument that equals misconduct then have to get referred to bar associations as ethical misconduct?
Your Honor, I do not know. I imagine that would be from each state to state. And of course, there's a difference between misconduct and reversible trial counsel misconduct.
Well, counsel. Is it your position that it's impermissible argument for a counsel to speculate as to why an accused did what they did?
No, Your Honor, as long as that speculation is based on the facts of the record.
Well, so if they speculated that that he did it because he didn't care if she died, because he, or he did it because he wanted to go commit adultery with the other airman, or because he wanted to go do more drugs, all of that would have been fine.
If you're saying they argued that he took her home to die in order so that he could go have sex with another airman, no, that would be impermissible, because that still goes back to the whole idea of death and the likelihood of death. Now, if they had some type of argument that it was he did this because he wanted liver damage to occur because of some odd reason, then that would be fair, and it would be based on the facts.
But at the time that all this happened, right? Do we know that he knew that she was only going to potentially get liver damage? I mean, she took 60 pills. She took 60 pills. He said in his stipulation of fact that, you know, you're not going to die here. And she said, yes, I am going to die here. And then he went and he left him alone in the apartment. So I guess all I'm asking you is, you seem to be saying that it's improper argument to infer from those facts, you know, to suggest there's one motivation, why did he do what he did? And so I'm asking you, is that in fact your argument?
That is a portion of the argument, and I see that my time is about to expire. May I finish the answer?
See if you can say it in 2 seconds.
I really don't. I'm certainly not a medical doctor, nor am I a pharmacist. Everything I know about the drug lorazepam comes from the stipulation of fact. Everything the members knew about the drug lorazepam came from the stipulation of fact. And the only thing we know from the stipulation of fact is that death is extremely rare, even in the most extreme doses. That's all we know. That's all we know about it. And it would be improper to hypothesize as to what else could have been going through or what else could have happened at that point. Because all we know is what is in the stipulation of fact. And with that, if there are no further questions.
Are there any further questions up there? Thank counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted and we'll stand in recess until 10:25, please.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:25.